Hello everyone and welcome to episode 89 of Dominaria Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And I guess also welcome back to me. I was out last week. I had the plague, was not sure I would even make it to my own regional championship. But luckily, Jarvis Yu, friend of the show, and now also edging me out as potential co-host of the show, stepped in to fill the void there.
You still have him on the numbers game. He's recurred. He's recurred at least, two times? And, you know, sometimes you just have a recurring a guest host. It's just how it works.
Yeah, he has racked up some number of appearances. Really hard to distinguish exactly how many at this point, but good to have him there on hand in case one of us is out for the count. But I am back. I have a trip report, I suppose, for my own RC, and we had a whole wave of them this weekend. And we have even still a gap of a few weeks until the San Diego Regional Championships for the US, which is the one that I think will garner the most attention. But that brings up a topic, I guess, which... Back in the day, you know, when I was getting into Magic, I think that the closest analog would be Nationals, where you would have a new set and you would have this kind of big standard format leading up to the rotation, so usually 8-set standard. And across that span, that 8-set usually would reinvigorate the format, add some new things to it, cause some churn in there. And then over the course of that 8-set standard cycle, you would see the format that the first group played for the first week of Nationals look very different from the one that you would be playing by the end of the season. And UK Nationals was almost always tucked away near there at the end. And so it felt like any preparation that was more than 3 or 4 weeks old was effectively obsoleted by the time that you got to the last few weeks, because all cues would just be taken from whatever did well in the US, in France, in Canada, what have you. So this isn't quite the same cadence that we had back in the day, but it's bringing back some mostly negative memories from that.
Yeah, the fourth set of the previous year did some weird stuff. I have probably alluded to this incident, but I believe there was a point where a set was added mid-season, and that set was Cold Snap, and that put Sensei's Divining Top and Counterbalance into standard together, and US Nationals did not have that, and Japanese Nationals did, and some interesting things happened in the middle because of that.
Cold Snap was just a real disaster of a set in many different aspects there. And yeah, I remember that season quite vividly, where you took a format which had reached this almost unprecedented level of flourishing, although in retrospect, there's always this debate over had there been a more critical focus on it at the time, would it have aged all that well? And Cold Snap was the ultimate cat thrown among those pigeons, and the last 2 months or so of that format was just a complete weird mess.
Yeah, I think this discussion's been revived a lot, too, in the context of Limited, in terms of like how much does the modern era of just larger data change stuff. There's a lot of things that you could discuss that might make a difference, but I think some of these old formats would hold up, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just saying that because I was there for them, and like opinions about the past, nostalgia, rose-colored glasses, those kinds of things. But on the subject of good formats, I do want to say this standard format is, I don't want to say it's like one of the best, but it's pretty good. I'm really impressed with it.
Yeah, I know some people do want to say that. I have seen several people saying, like, this is the best standard format in years, or one of the best of all time. And I don't know if that's true, and just in the dark is unlikely for it to be true. That there have been a lot of standard formats, not just in the past 5 years, but then all time as well. And there are specific aspects of this standard which I think you can certainly take issue with, and I'm sure we will over the course of this episode. But more broadly, I just don't know if those comparisons are really necessary. It felt like we came out of this period where there was no focus on standard, and the people who did have to play standard, whether for their MPL league weekends or what have you, weren't really enjoying it all that much. And I think maybe as an overcorrection, there's this need to find the first standard format which people do seem to enjoy playing and latch onto it as, oh my god, it's back, baby. Standard is good again. And it is good again. I don't know if it's the best of all time, and I don't think it's really productive to frame it in those terms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was this ongoing narrative / question, like, not like, you know, the reason people wonder if these old standard formats were as good as we thought they were is because standard was bad for so long that people wondered if standard could be good again. And the answer is, like, very clearly, yes. I agree with you. Like, I know Autumn tweeted that this is the best standard format since, you know, 2018 or something. And I think there have been multiple formats since that point that have been better. But I also, some of that is just like, I enjoy Team Erect Mirrors too much to like, I think that format was better, even if it was worse by all metrics.
Autumn may enjoy Team Erect Mirrors more than any other human alive, so I think they would agree on you on that count.
Yeah, so I think that this format's good. It's not as good as some of the ones that have popped up, but like, I don't know, if you were grading it on a scale of like 1 to 10, it's probably at least a 7.
Yeah, I think that's 7 plus, and it certainly looked like this might be another one of those failed standard formats a few weeks ago when every challenge top 8 was 6 out of 8 Grixis 1 week or 6 out of 8 Mono White the next week, and it felt like maybe this is another one of those like 1 to 2 deck standard formats, and okay, great, we'll try again next season, except this is the one season where the first wave of big competitive tournaments is going to be standard, and so if this standard format is bad, maybe it takes the whole thing down with it. And luckily, it seems like it has opened up a lot since then, and maybe having that much attention on the format has led to good things in a way that some of these formats are in between where, yeah, we just kind of write them off. Maybe those suffer from the neglect of that. If we had had more people with a reason to care, maybe those would have been seen as more diverse than just the weekly challenge top eights painted a picture of.
I agree with that. I think that the keys are reason to care and iterated weeks. Like, we saw this as well in the, was it Zendikar Rising era? After they banned all the Omnath and Uro garbage. If you look at there was the SCG online PTQ meta of that era where like, the iteration week to week was very obvious, very huge, and like, very clearly, like, that is the format I would identify as the best standard format of the, like, fire era of design. And, like, it's very clearly because people were given the reasons to, like, try and win Gruul Mirrors, but also, like, reiterate on the Gruul versus Mono Green Food matchup over and over, or, like, grind the ins and outs of Dimir Rogues and, like, just, like, all this stuff that, you know, if you only had one weekend or people just sort of like playing the thing that's the freest wins, wouldn't happen. So yeah, I think that this format has definitely benefited from that. I've come to the conclusion that there are two decks in this format I like. One of them is Grixis, and I think it's very possible we end up at the end stage where like Grixis is just the best deck, and everyone who was like playing week by week was just exploiting a specific week's weakness in the Grixis list.
Yeah, I don't think Grixis is necessarily where it was a few weeks ago, whereas why on earth would you consider playing anything else? But I do think that you can never go that far wrong playing Grixis, and whatever the results of last weekend's tournaments were, you can reconfigure your Grixis list by changing 4 or 5 cards, and if that was a bad matchup last week, it might not necessarily be a bad matchup the following week. And I think Grixis does have a few structural issues that you can exploit there, but by and large, it is just a very solid mid-range deck that plays good, honest magic, and I think we'll start our discussion of specific decks with Grixis then, because I think this will be the litmus test throughout. I think it will be the most popular deck in any standard tournament, and to me, it's very reminiscent of some of these classic three-color mid-range decks that have defined formats in their time. So, you know, Team Energy and then Grixis Energy later on. You think of, like, the Sultai decks in Ravnica Allegiant Standard and then the Esper decks after that. And one thing that all of those color combinations have in common, actually, is blue. And I don't think that's a coincidence. So, if you look at what actually gets you to Grixis as opposed to Jund, or you can take that Rakdos shell in any number of directions. Corpse Appraiser is nice, like that's a good magic card, but I think it's actually stuff like Make Disappear, Negate, Disdainful Stroke that really elevate the deck to the next level, because as we saw with, you know, the Team Energies of the world, typically it's quite easy to go over the top of those decks in a number of different ways, and usually you can do that fairly often in game one scenarios, but actually doing that over the course of a 3-game set when you're running into a wall of negates and so on, and there's like 2-mana counter magic after sideboarding, your big 7-drop or 8-drop that's trying to go over the top, like, just that is not a reliable approach anymore, if it even was in the first place.
Yeah, well, I do want to point to another aspect of this deck and a lot of these other decks, is that the core thing that Grixis does better than a lot of other decks is that it can start getting aggressive on turn 2 if the role calls for it. If you look at these like classic 3-color mid-range decks, they're at their absolute peak when you have that aggressive two drop. So the Long Tusk Cub, the Putrid Leech is the one that comes to mind as being the closest to Blood Tithe Harvester, because there's this idea of, like, with Long Tusk Cub, you could attack into the cub, like, there was a little bit of window and play there on turn two. With Leech, it's just like, yeah, okay. So, this is a 4-4 on defense, that's really bad for me, and it's just gonna attack me if you, you know, if I, like, miss a beat, and I'll just be the on the defense, that's really bad for me. And you kind of get the same thing with Harvester, where, like, if you just miss a beat with any of the aggressive decks, Harvester will clock you. If you just, like, attack into it, the trade is very profitable for the Grixis deck, because either they trade there and they have the blood token still around for, like, the next Harvester, or, like, it can force trades with creatures that, you know, it effectively deals with, like, any idea of, like, oh, I'm going to fly my Harbin over. It's like, no, it's just going to die. So I think that card, and, like, less so Bankbuster, but, like, that card plays a similar role in a lot of matchups. And, like, I don't know, sometimes you just get beat down by Corpse Appraiser. Just, like, not the most efficient, but, like, you know, very similar to Sprouting Thrynax in the classic Jun deck. Just, like, big thing, value, bad to trade with, also just a relevant clock. I think that's a really key component of why this Grixis deck is so good. And that all ignores Fable, because Fable is just completely out of this world.
Yeah, I mean, Fable is the best card, has been basically since it was printed into Standard, probably. And when they hit Meathook Massacre a few months ago in an attempt to curtail Black Midrange, it seemed like that was kind of missing the forest for the trees, in the sense of it didn't really change the fundamentals. And also, the best card was Fable before, and Meathook was actually one of the better ways at cleaning up a Fable or breaking serve against it on the draw. So Fable's dominance was just cemented there even further. But as you say, yeah, Reckoner Bankbuster and Corpse Appraiser, these are amazing tools for winning longer games. But sometimes you go turn two Bankbuster, turn three Corpse Appraiser as Trained Armadon, crew my Bankbuster, attack for four, and that is a shockingly fast clock against a deck that is not prepared to win that kind of fight.
Yeah, and I guess we should probably talk about the other card here, which is Invoke Despair. That card is... I know that, like, there's this whole debate about, like, oh, you can do all these other things with Grixis. They're all just worse than casting Invoke. I think that there's this idea of, like, oh, I can make Invoke bad by doing all these things. It's like, no, you're... Yes, Invoke is not going to be absolutely devastating if it makes you sacrifice a token. They're still gonna draw two and you lose four. Like, it, the experience of playing with Invoke Despair reminds me a lot of the experience of playing with, like, Cryptic Command and Cruel Ultimatum, where, like, the game is starts off close and then suddenly your opponent is just, instead of, like, being close, they're just dead. Like, they don't have a life total. Like, one of the specifics is, like, the mono red matchup for Grixis. I think that You would almost be inclined to, like, maybe think about sideboarding out Invoke, because it is an expensive card that doesn't trade. What really, like, I don't know, we could go into depth about, like, how Grixis is supposed to address the different monocolor decks in the format, or, like, the different aggro decks, because it's, like, a sort of interesting subtopic. But, like, in the mono-red matchup, you just, like, cast Invoke against them, and, like, if it hits a creature, that's phenomenal. But, like, just draw two cards when you're trying to exchange cards to prevent them from killing you, that's good. But also, like, if you deal four damage to them, that's also another card, because that's another turn or so less of time drawing off the top of their deck that they have to find a lightning strike. I don't know. That card's just so good. It's really absurd.
I do think these points play into each other as well, where the fact that Grixis has this aggressive capability is what makes it a good Invoke Despair deck, where even if you can set yourself up with a certain configuration of card types to blunt the impact of Invoke Despair, or try and, like, cushion yourself against a life loss by actually wanting to sacrifice a bunch of different things, just Invoke happening to deal two or four on top of everything else that it's doing, and maybe leading into the second Evoke in the process, the fact that that is a realistic threat because you are under pressure is what makes the card just kind of good across the board, as opposed to just good in a certain few matchups and maybe a clunky five drop in others. Likewise, I think Grixis is a phenomenal Shieldred deck, where kind of all the other incentives push you away from the kind of cards that are good against Shieldred, right? Where just the one-for-one spot removal that's good against Shieldred, not really that good against any other aspect of the Grixis deck, but you kind of need some amount of it in order to pay Shieldred due respect, and then you're drawing a bunch of cards yourself with Blood Tokens and Fable and so on, but then you're also applying pressure, so dealing two to them a turn at least is a relevant clock. And yeah, I mean, I think this is a good shell across the board, but also the fact that you can be that flexible means there's a broader orbit of cards that are especially good with the other Grixis cards.
Well, I guess let's talk about Shieldred, because that has been one of the biggest jumps from what I, you know, that whole like Magic Online Challenge era to the Championship era, is just the Grixis decks have started playing Shieldred again. And I think that some of this is like, it might just be like a Magic Online player diff thing where, like, in the mirrors, Shieldred is a card that is not, I don't want to say it's bad in Grixis mirrors, takes the agency out of your hands a bit and turns the game into a lot about, if they don't kill Shieldred, that's great. If they do kill Shieldred, it's so dicey to fight over in a lot of spots. And, like, it really polarizes a game where, like, if you are one of those deep moto grinders, you could just, like, I don't know, if you just play a non-shouldered game of the mirror, you're probably going to come out ahead. So it's this idea of, like, the best players start cutting Shieldred because it maximizes their, it, like, doesn't change the actual win rate of the mirror, but it maximizes their, like, game time played and, like, their actual gameplay edges. And then everyone copies them, and then it's just, like, I don't know, no one's playing Shieldred, and then, like, they show up in the real world and play five matches against decks that aren't the mirror, and they're like, oh, I'm just going to put Shieldred back in my deck and just beat everyone else. And I think that that was a pretty big thing that first weekend of championships. Like, even if you look at the Toxic matchup, like, Shieldred is just good there because it's big and has power and toughness. And their deck does not deal with big things with power and toughness well. Like, they're designed in such a way that, like, if you try to one-for-one all of their stuff, they're going to come out ahead on, like, mana or just, like, raw cards. If you just one-for-one a lot of their things, and then it's just, like, I don't know, they have two creatures and you have a Shieldred, like, they, I don't know, what are they doing? Nothing. They die.
Yeah, Shieldred, it's an amazing card. Play the good cards. Don't overthink it. Don't try and get too smart for your own good. It is just a great Magic card. You need a good burden of proof to claim that it is bad in a particular matchup. I think people want to say it's bad in the Grixis mirrors because, as you say, it's the kind of thing where, unlike all of the other cards, it kind of does exactly one thing despite the number of triggers it generates and despite kind of how good it is across the board. It's just like this big object which, if it resolves and it sticks around, yeah, you probably win the game, but they can fight over it. You can't really defend it that easily. Sometimes you win the fight over Shieldred if it's your only creature, and so it gets immediately trumped by Invoke Despair or something. So I think it leads itself to blowouts in the other direction the way that none of your other cards really do, and because it costs four, you can't like accept that as just the cost of doing business, because the Grixis mirror, like, tempo does matter a lot, and losing out on that access is quite punishing. That being said, I think the upside is high enough that you just accept that and you do it anyway. And I think if your opponents know that you never have Shieldred in your deck, you become much more exploitable, where, you know, they can cut a lot more of their one-for-one removal. They know that you have no way of effectively replenishing your own life total, and so just taking these hyper-aggressive lines makes more sense. And then the fact that Razor Lash Transmogrant was figured out as this mirror breaker, which I do think it is, I think makes Shieldred even more important, because this is one way that you can actually play defense effectively against a Transmogrant that doesn't rely on having exactly, you know, Anoint with Affliction or Flame Blessed Bolt or something like that. Like, Shieldred does stop a Transmogrant in its tracks in a way that no other card in the Grixis deck really does, and that is part of why that card is so effective in the Grixis mirrors and just against Grixis in general out of other decks. And so if Shieldred is being adopted by stuff like Esper Legends and more widely, then that increases Shieldred's importance even further. So I don't know if I would agree with the people who say that it's a bad card in the mirror, and it is one of your better cards in basically every other context. And so, yeah, I think just leaning on that card makes more and more sense as the weeks go by.
Yeah, the other trend that I sort of notice is an increase in sweepers in a lot of these decks. And that may just be related to the, like, people are playing other decks, and therefore you put Brotherhood's End in your deck because they might play a Skrellside. I don't have a lot of opinions beyond that on, you know, why two Brotherhood's End became the stock or whatever, but It's just worth noting moving forward that, like, that is probably a thing you should keep doing, because the results have still shown a lot of these decks that, like, I would love to have a sweeper against any soldiers. I'd love to have a sweeper against Toxic. Those decks are still doing well. I should put sweepers in my deck.
Yeah, I do think some of that is the sweepers can be good in the mirrors. So situationally, of course, but I think there is room for some amount of those situational cards when you have Bloodtithe Harvester, you have Fable, you have ways to exchange these dead cards for other ones. And Brotherhood's End in particular, this is a way that you can catch up when you're behind on board instead of having to trade one for one with everything that's there. And the reason that Fable is the best card in Standard and maybe other formats too is you can't really trade one for one with that card. Whereas sometimes against a Fable, you know, you let it get to Chapter 3, maybe they have a Bloodtithe Harvester or a Corpse Appraiser or something, and then your Brotherhood's End cleans up everything, and you don't have to, you know, cut down one half of Fable and then abrade the Corpse Appraiser, and, oh, I can't really let this Goblin token keep hitting me, so maybe I have to point removal like that too. You just get everything, and you don't have to throw a bunch of cards in the void dealing with that. And then, yeah, it's one of the best cards to have my deck against soldiers, against mono red, against toxic, against just a bunch of stuff like that. And especially in a open deck list environment, not having it main deck gives your opponent the freedom to just commit everything to the board and force you to deal with everything one by one, whereas the presence of Brotherhood's End forces them to at least pay respect to that. And as we've learned across the years, players are not good at paying due respect in a balanced way to these kind of high impact one-offs or two-offs, which, you know, don't come up in games with high frequency, but when they do, are likely to have a very big impact.
Yeah, I've had this experience with Brotherhood's End that's kind of the opposite of what you're describing, where, like, I think the scenarios where you are so far behind but your opponent is exposed to exactly Brotherhood's End are pretty rare. What's a lot more common are the ones where, like, you're just ahead and then you have Brotherhood's End in your hand and it's just terrible. So I don't know. I'm adverse to having it even in, like, all these, like, oh, but it exposed, you know, they might do it. I don't know. I don't really buy that. But at the same time, like, I understand where, like, it is capable of being a functional card, and that is probably, you know, it's not like a Braid was doing much in the mirror game ones. Like, it's, I don't know. I'm totally fine with just, like, Brotherhood's End being effectively, like, that card in that slot.
Mm-hmm. We should talk about Transmogrant a little more, I think. So this is the 2-drop, 2-mana, 3-1. You can pay BB, or 4BB, rather, to return it from your graveyard to the battlefield with a +1/+1 to counter on it, and this costs 4 less if your opponent has 4 or more non-basic lands, which Grixis effectively always will. And so this is a card which was... I don't know if there was one particular source that discovered it. It felt like a lot of people kind of gravitated towards this independently. But over the course of the last week or two, this card is now everywhere, including one or two copies in main decks even, almost purely as a response to Grixis. And from what I've seen, this card is the real deal. This is the best way to really get an edge in the Grixis mirror. Like we said, the fact that the answers are so cheap means that trying to go over the top with, you know, you could play like 4 Blade Coil Serpent or whatever. This is an idea that people tried for a while, but then that has severe diminishing returns against stuff like May Disappear, Negate, and so on. But having this cheap threat, which synergizes nicely in a way with other cards in your deck, like you can casualty May Disappear and then just return it immediately, or you can pitch it to a Fable and then return it later on, and so kind of gain a card in that equation too. But it is also just, you play it on turn two, and they can't really answer it one for one, but they have to, and eventually they just die, and the rest of your deck contains so many answers yourself that you can, like, force it through and create a board where it can flourish. And so it is ideal for conditions in the Grixis mirror. I think other decks can turn to it to improve their Grixis matchups, but can't rely on the same dynamic happening. So in Esper Legends, for example, I think this maybe is the answer to what is a 2-drop we want that doesn't just die to yet another cutdown, but if you're getting brick walled by a Shielded or something in that matchup, or your lack of interaction is hurting against a Fable plus Bloodtithe Harvester board, well, Transmogrant is good, but it's not going to fix that underlying issue there.
If you are playing Esper Legends and you land a Transmogrant, your opponent has the ability to just turn up the heat, become the aggressive deck, grind you down on cards, and race this stupid 3-1. And the Esper deck is really bad when it's on the back foot. The Grixis deck playing the other Grixis deck is not allowed to do that. Like, you can't just, like, put your other Grixis opponent on the back foot and trust that their deck will roll over, because that's just not it. I think that, like, another important thing with Transmogrant is that the only card that beats Transmogrant and any other card in their deck is Soul Transfer. Like, if you put Anoint in your deck to deal with Transmogrant, and you anoint a Harvester or a Corpse Appraiser or, like, any, like, that's just bad. Like, you're not anointing a card that matters. Soul Transfer might kill Shieldred. That's really the break with it.
Yeah, it's the fact that you have all of these very kind of bespoke removal spells that deal with Transmogrant, but those are not cards you would want too much of in the mirrors anyway. Like, you don't want a pile of Magma Sprays and Smothers and God knows what else. Like, those cards aren't what the mirrors are really about past a certain point. And so, yeah, Transmogrant forces them to respect it by diluting their deck in the process as well. So you gain some amount there. Whereas if you are the Esper Legends deck, for example, you'll gladly show up with a bunch of Anoint with Afflictions to kill, you know, if it's not Transmogrant, well, it's Thalia or it's Adeline or it's Denik, or, you know, the list goes on.
Yeah, I think that there's, like, a side note here about, like, another reason Grixis is so strong against the format in general that's related, is that Grixis gets access to, like, there is a traditional thing where, like, oh, I'm going to beat this mid-range deck with a weird card type, and that just doesn't work anymore in Standard, because the Grixis deck's removal is, like, okay, so I'm going to try to beat them with the Planeswalker. Nope, I'm going to get invoked. I'm going to try to beat them with Enchantment. Nope, getting invoked again. I'm going to try and beat them with an Artifact. There's a Braid. Like, it is very hard to find a card that dodges the removal speed of Grixis unless you are just, like, playing a card that doesn't die to removal. And that's what Transmogrant represents.
The enchantment thing is funny, because this is one way that people have actually tried to exploit Grixis, is that these are the three worst colors, both black and red famously, but also blue is not great at it either. These colors cannot deal with enchantments, and so just show up with powerful enchantments and hopefully those will get the job done. Invoke is really good against a singular enchantment, and so at that point, the way you beat Invoke becomes to just layer on as many enchantments as possible so that you have inbuilt Invoke protection. And so, yeah, you see these Totic decks pivoting into Four Scrolls High, Four Wedding Announcement. The idea being, okay, well, I'll just try and stick one of these, and that'll be enough to grind them out. Or the Mono White deck, for example, right? It is just a pile of enchantments, essentially, and cards that kind of resemble enchantments if you look at them from the right angle.
Yeah, that... I mean, you want to segue into discussing the Mono White deck, because that is what you played. It's really hard to, like, talk more about Grixis, because it's just, like, good card central, and it plays aggro and defense really well, and, like, it is on every other deck in the format to come up with a reason why they are not Grixis. Why, like, the Mono White deck, do you believe it's actually solid versus Grixis ahead? Like, where does that fall?
Hard for me to say, because I somehow didn't play against normal Grixis in all 13 rounds this weekend, despite it being 30% of the room or whatever. But yeah, I think it is good against Grixis, and you can lean into that harder if you want to. And it's kind of hard for Grixis to do more in response other than go towards these approaches which have fallen out of favor in the mirror. So yeah, if your opponent is showing up with a pile of Baycore Serpents, they're going to be pretty good against Mono White, but most people just aren't doing that, and for understandable reasons. I think Mono White, though, is just has kind of inbuilt structural flaws as a deck, and it's, as the format kind of expands, some of the aggro decks do actually pose a problem for Mono White. Like, they can go underneath you unless you pay them enough respect, but then you have people going over the top with their Atraxa piles and so on, and it just inherently, as a expensive mono white card deck, you can't really adapt to that fight very much. And then mono blue is just an absolute nightmare, and that was a weird wrinkle about this whole weekend, which we can get into. So yeah, if you have a narrowly tailored task of just beating Grixis, I think this deck is good at that. And then part of my reasoning for this weekend was just, it was an easy default, and I thought there would be more aggro coming out of last week, and so you could play a build that beats up an aggro, and then also the Grixis decks would have to prepare more for aggro than for these grindy mid-range slugfests, and so that would make them even weaker against you as well. So it never really got to test one half of that equation, but the aggro half did show up in force, I suppose. I think, though, that even though Mono White did win the Vancouver RC, and it was a very radical approach, just playing like the 8 Field of Ruins and just trying to stone rain one half of the format into oblivion, that you can do that, but the fact that you have to points to just other reasons that maybe the deck isn't worth pursuing.
Yeah, I've kind of got the impression that, like, so One of the things I noticed playing Grixis against the mono white decks is that I felt like I could maneuver my way to a favor. Like, I felt like I could play my way out of the matchup, but, like, my opponents could warp their deck in very significant ways to make it harder for me to do that, doing things like, I'm just, like, if they just didn't play any cheap creatures besides maybe Spirited Companion, then the matchup got a lot worse because, like, one of the things is, like, if they just never put a thing into the graveyard to get Corpse Appraised, then it's a, you know, a card that sits in your hand and sometimes gets clumped up. Like, the way Spirited Companion works against Invoke was pretty good. If they just never played Eternal Wanderer, the big one, like, they just didn't have cards that got straight up owned by Invoke. I'm just trying to think of, like, other, like, very small things. And even then, I was kind of like, I don't know, I'm just going to put more Duresses in my deck, and then I'll just Duress their wedding announcement, and it'll be fine. I think that, like, every single sacrifice that that deck makes to beat Grixis is a very, like, it's like, I'm just not going to play cheap creatures or Steel Seraph, which I don't really understand if it's actually good, but it certainly, like, is annoying for some of the aggressive decks. Like, every card that you cut to beat Grixis on a mono white has a huge impact on your other matchups, where I think this is a classic problem where, like, you have really dominant mid-range deck, and then you have other mid-range deck that is inbred to beat it, and it's, like, 55% in the matchup. And if you were just, like, a good Grixis player with a good Grixis list, you'd be, like, 53% in the mirror and not lose 10% everywhere else.
Yeah, I think this is the big story with a lot of the Atraxa decks, too. So the Cruelty of Grix Atraxa decks, which was what I was somewhat leaning towards at this point last week, but what I couldn't really answer effectively was, okay, if Grixis wants to beat me, it probably can. And also, I'm not convinced I'm that much better than Grixis against basically anything else. And I'm also more exploitable in this very obvious and inviting way. So yeah, if Grixis is showing up with some actual graveyard hay or just more cards like Mage's Appear and so on, that seems like bad news for me. But also, if the room happens to be, again, 25% mono blue somehow, then yeah, would much rather be on Grixis as opposed to the Cruelty of Grix Atraxa deck. I think there is some case to be made that, for that deck specifically, not talking about mono white here for a second, that in a format that is opening up, there is a draw to just doing a very fundamentally powerful thing, where, like, yeah, maybe my removal suite isn't quite configured for this toxic match that I'm playing against, but if I just flop a Traxa into play on turn 5, well, that can find me the tools I need to close it out. And that is true to some extent, but I don't know. I think that there was a reason that those decks have mostly fallen off after their initial popularity.
I didn't try a bunch of the Grixis Atraxa lists just because I'm, like, so enamored with Invoke, and I think cutting it is just bananas. But I did try some of the Bant five-color domain deck, and I kind of got this experience where, like, I would cast Atraxa, and I would put 5 cards in my hand, and then my opponents would remind me that Invoke is a card. It's just like, yeah, okay, great. Like, what am I, like, my endgame is not... So, I think if you just, like, let's go back to that Invoke as Cruel Ultimatum thing, like, it's... When you talk about, like, Cruel Ultimatum as this, like, 7-mana control finisher, it's, like, very blatant what is occurring, where, like, it's not just the fact that you go up on resources, it's that your opponent is stripped of so many resources that they are non-threatening the next turn. And Atraxa just, it doesn't do that in this format. It just really doesn't. So you are, like, the turn Atraxa resolves, or even the turn after, like, extremely exposed and very likely to just, like, lose to any single piece of removal, has been my experience. Or the game was so close that you don't need an Atraxa, so who cares? I don't really know, like, what the middle ground is, except for, like, your opponent forgot to put cards in their deck to kill Atraxa.
Yeah, I think that 5-color shell, the domain deck, does intrigue me. I'm not sure it even wants or needs to be an Atraxa deck, necessarily, is the thing. And there is this temptation for greed with these 5-color decks, where because you are all 5 colors, you can do basically whatever you want. And you usually, if you're doing this in the first place, is because you want to do the big flashy thing that drew you into playing 5 colors in the first place. But I don't think you need to do that necessarily. I think you can be a kind of a Bant mid-rangey plus deck with a bunch of the same cards, with maybe a more curated selection of finishers, and that might just be a more solid deck in the grand scheme of things.
So how good was the card Loran against your mono white deck, or the card Miglaws? Because the Bant deck could never defeat those cards. Just so much of its removal base was tied up in resolving an enchantment, and if that enchantment died, the game was just over. Like, if you would just get Loran, and you'd be like, well, that's cool. And as long as your opponent did it in a context where the card Depopulate was not just free-rolling them, like, it was just so bad. Like, the mono-white deck at least has a spread of, like, Sarah Paragon, Sanctuary Warden. Maybe you could build a Bant deck that goes down that road, but I don't know. I think, like, the mono-white deck with, like, Laydown Arms is accomplishing so much more than, you know, all-inning on Leyline Binding plus Ossification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think the mono white deck is actually beating those cards either in practice. Let's talk about this mono blue deck, which somehow took the Vancouver RC by storm and basically none of the others, as far as I can tell. So this is a deck which I would describe this as like the arena MTG Twitter deck, where like, yeah, if you go on certain subsets of the community, this is the best deck in Standard, this is the most popular deck in Standard, because this is a very easy deck to do your daily arena quest with, very easy to craft, very easy to build on paper as well. I think that's one thing that this deck, and maybe this format, does actually have going for it, is there is a viable and fun deck that's, you know, costs $30 to build on paper and is, you know, strong and competitive and fun. That is a good thing for a format to have in its corner. But What I think that some amount of that is priced into the paper experience, certainly, and also like the arena experience, or like if you're playing leagues on Modo as well. But when you get to the actual higher echelons of competitive play, you expect it to fall off a bit. What happened here in Canada is one of the prominent BC grinders, Nam Dang, Namasquats on Modo, a very accomplished player, he was seen just 5-0ing at League with a deck, and as a result, a bunch of the other local players all started picking it up and like playing it, and the local hive mind congealed around this being like the answer to Standard. And so you had these two camps of the camp you'd expect of, I just want to play Standard, this deck costs $20 and is fun, the other ones cost hundreds of bucks and maybe are not fun, so of course that's going to be the most popular deck there. And then also, you had the people who had been grinding hardcore for the tournament and decided that Mono Blue was the best deck, and those two camps met in the middle and somehow made Mono Blue the second most popular deck between them.
Yeah, I do want you... Actually, you might know the answer. What was the highest placing Mono Blue deck in this tournament?
I wasn't in the top 8, I can tell you that much. I think it was... I'm not even sure if the top 16 had one. I think it might have been like 18th, 19th place, something like that.
30th.
Oh, dear God.
Okay, so anyways, I have not played with or against Mono Blue somehow. I've like managed to dodge it in like, I don't... dozens, you know, like, I don't know, however many matches of Standard like I play in like a given week or whatever. Just, I don't play against it. And I think part of that is because it's bad. And I think part of that is because the more your metagame, like if you play the Magic Online leagues, there is a significant lack of Grixis, right? Like people just don't play Grixis because it is literally $1 million and like they just don't show up in the leagues with it. And everything that like, even if you convince yourself your mono blue deck is good versus Grixis, all the decks people are playing instead of Grixis are so good against you. Like, I don't know how you're supposed to beat like, I don't know, Mono Red or Rakdos or Soldiers or like Toxic with this Mono Blue deck that is like, just not.
Okay, I was going to say, I think it's a very simple line of, you beat the people who are trying to go over the top of Grixis and you lose to the people who are trying to go underneath Grixis. Like, Soldiers had an amazing weekend at the Vancouver RC specifically because of all the Mono Blue, and they had a high enough win rate that it wasn't just that. I think Soldiers was a good deck for the tournament. But yeah, if your opponent just plays Recruitment Officer on turn 1, you are dead to rights. There is no coming back from that.
Yeah, I also think that this Mono Blue deck specifically, it highlights, like, I think there's just this play pattern, and this is, I guess, going further down this road of, like, you know, the different aggro decks and Standard. Like, Grixis beats the mono red deck by, like, playing a game of trading cards until the best way to trade cards is your opponent's life total goes to 0 and they never draw another card. Against the mono blue deck, like, this list is just maximized for, like, the way that these decks are supposed to beat mono blue decks, which is, if you just play, like, the whole concept of beating a mono blue deck with a mid-range deck is just play the cheapest spells you can, and then as soon as you resolve two spells in a turn, they are under so much pressure to have exactly the right things. Like, this was the plan that I used to be successful in the, like, you know, Autumn wins the Mythic Championship with mono blue. I was playing Sultai, and I don't remember how many mono blue opponents I beat in that tournament, but a lot. And, like, it was just on the back of, like, every game where I hit my first four land drops, I would double spell on turn four, and their entire game would fall apart. And, like, I don't know, this mono blue deck doesn't even have, like, one drop threats half the time. Like, I don't really know what it's gonna accomplish if, like, its cards don't line up perfectly the whole way up the curve against a Grixis opponent who just decides to make every card in their deck cheap and matter, which is also just, like, the structural way every aggro deck trying to undercut Grixis is going. So, like, yeah, I would not touch this deck. I don't know, like, it would take a lot of very specific conditions for me to do that. Flow of Knowledge, though, very powerful card.
Yeah, I think that mono blue deck, the Autumn one they're PT with, is an evocative comparison because people have been trying to recapture that specific high for so long now that any deck that kind of looks like that immediately gets penciled in as, oh, this is the next coming of mono blue shitters, as it was once affectionately known. This is not that deck. Outside of, I guess, running somewhere between like 18 and 21 islands, like there is really no conceptual similarity otherwise. And I think that trying to shoehorn this deck into that mold is only going to lead to even worse outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, Haughty Jin, I think, is probably better than any equivalent that has existed for this kind of archetype before. But, like, I don't know. When you start looking at Haughty Jin, you draw this comparison to Enigma Drake, and you're then drawing this comparison to a million other decks that have, like, a Fiery Impulse or Shock. And this deck does not have a Shock. It has Fading Hope. Fading Hope is not a Shock.
Yeah, I don't think this deck is completely unsalvageable, but I think you get to this fork in the road very quickly of, do you just completely write off all of the aggro decks and try to optimize your deck for the things that it is already good at? And I think that is a fine gamble to take, but you have to be aware that you're taking it. Or do you try and fix that problem and make whatever the sacrifices are that are needed to do that? So whether it's, you know, four main deck Blue Suns Twilight, or it's I don't know if there's some, like, Letter Shred is fine, but it's not the answer. If there's some cheap creature with high toughness you can play in your sideboard, I don't know what the answer is here. This is beyond my remit, but I think you have to decide what you're trying to do with your mono blue deck and then have a long and hard conversation about whether it can actually do that. I do think as well, the fact that it is, like, the default deck for people who just want to play some games of Standard does drag its win rate down in the way that, like, Burn in Modern always looks worse than it probably is just because of user error in some regards. But when you look at the people who, you know, that contingent I mentioned, who are good Magic players and consciously chose Mono Blue for this tournament, none of them did well either. So maybe that should be a warning sign.
Yeah, you did mention Blue Suns Twilight, which is, I think, so I want to rewind off of the topic of Mono Blue to Grixis versus Mono White. I think that Grixis cutting that card from their deck is actually, like, a prime spot for exploit in the format, because I was mostly playing Grixis with a bunch of Twilights, like two or whatever was the stock, and that was game-breaking against Mono White, because one of the ways they try to make everything up is that Sanctuary Warden is so good against every answer that the Grixis deck boards in to beat your Wedding Announcement half of your deck, except for if they resolve Blue Suns Twilight, the game immediately ends. So, like, if they don't have that card, you actually have something that is really threatening.
Or Owl as well. Like, Blue Suns Twilight in those longer games was one of the best answers to Owl, and the fact that no one's playing that card anymore means that maybe Mono White, but specifically decks like Esper Legends or even Four Color Legends, which I certainly want to circle back to, can lean on that card a little harder. So that's Mono Blue. Let's touch on Mono Red quickly, which... It's a deck, it did fine, but I don't think it's especially inspiring.
Yeah, I don't love it. I am more interested in the follow-up versions of this deck that have started moving towards red. I'm trying to remember who, or not towards red, towards black with the
black,
red cards.
Yes.
Yes. So there was a copy in the top 8 of the face-to-face championship that was just, like, straight up Rakdos that was just, you know, Monastery Swiss Spear, Kumano Faces Kakazan, and then like Harvester, Trespasser, Shouldred. I played against, I'm trying to remember who online that was playing, a more, it looked like mono red, but like with the black removal, because otherwise the deck cannot defeat a Shouldred. I'm really interested in this approach to the deck. Like Kumano Faces Kakazan, really, really powerful card, but like, I don't really love a lot of the other mono red cards. Like, I think that the burn plan is pretty weak, even though this Rakdos list still is play with fire. I think that's more a concession to like pre-boarding against aggro mirrors than anything else. And like, I wish Lightning Strike was good. I wish like Thundering Raiju was better than it is. You cannot afford to have like that style of card in your deck against Grixis. Like, Feldon, not good. Phoenix Chick, not good. Squee is fine. I'm just comparing the mono red deck to the Rakdos deck, and I think the only card that the mono red deck gets to play that I like is Mishra's Foundry.
Yeah, this mono red deck, if you have been spoiled by other good mono red decks in the past, like the Chainmail red decks or what have you, then it's easy to just feel very underwhelmed by this one. And it has some cards which do go toe-to-toe with the best cards in some of those other red decks historically. So Kumano Faces Kakazan, one of the best one drops the red has had in a hot minute. But what are the cards that it gets to work with here? Like, you get to play a naked bloodthirsty adversary on turn two, and now you're hitting for three instead. It's like, okay, well, we hopefully can do better than that. So yeah, in a world where that card had good two drops to play with, then I would be more impressed. But as it is, it just kind of like, it feels like the supporting cast isn't there. And that adversary itself actually is one of those cards which you can imagine a world where the burn spells were better, where this card is like one of the big draws to be in mono red, and instead it's like fine plus, you play it because it's there, but it feels like it's kind of making up the numbers at the same time.
Yeah, well, I think more than the individual cards, I think there's just a structural misalignment of this red deck where, like, it is very reminiscent of Hellrider Red, which, like, the Pyroheart Wolf, Hellrider, Stormkirk, Noble, like, that's one of my favorite decks of Standard of all time. And the problem is that was a deck that was successful and designed for a format where people were light on removal and heavy on blockers. And what you did was you tried to undercut the blockers, create the best combats as possible, and when they finally resolved their big thing, you just had like a bigger combat. That's just not this format. This format is super heavy on removal. They're just going to kill all of your things. When I played that deck, the problem matchup was the Jeskai deck that was all kill spells and a couple good things. Like, that is just the description of what the Grixis deck is. It's like, I don't know, some cheap kill spells, like, cut down, can't beat that card ever. You know, maybe if your hand, like, perfectly lines up with, like, Kumano Faces Kakazan into Bloodthirsty Adversary, like, that's great, but, like, I don't know, the other half of your hands can't beat that card. And then they just play Shouldered, and then you're done. And, like, the red deck you would need to beat that is, like, super burn-heavy and, like, a lot of one-mana 2/1s, and those cards just don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the tribal aggro decks, if you like, of this format. And we'll start with Azorius Soldiers, which was one of the more popular decks a few weeks back, kind of fell off completely, and the talk was, okay, well, this deck just didn't really stand the test of time, and then came back in a big way this weekend. So two copies in the top 8 of Vancouver, and I think two more in top 16 or top 32, and had basically the highest win rate overall there. And then also another list winning the whole RC over in Taiwan as well. So, and this deck actually has a lot of interesting choices in deckboarding as well. So you can be just the straightforward play all the good soldiers, play all the good lords to pump your other soldiers, and just sprinkle in a few interactive spells and your 24 lands, and okay, that's your deck. But then, especially the winning list in Taiwan, this is almost like a flash deck of sorts, right? Shaving some of the cards that you might think would be sacred cows, like Thalia, and just playing a bunch of good instant speed spells instead.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a phenomenal idea. I think that Thalia is, like, I don't know, every format I play it in, it's just, like, less and less impressive. It is, like, technically a must-kill card for some of these control decks, but it just dies all the time to everything, or, like, whenever it's not a must-kill card, the game has gone horribly awry, and it's never going to fix it, and you just wonder why it's in your deck. I don't know. I have some structural issues with this deck too. Like, namely that it is a 24 land. And I think that the, let's, to like rewind to that list you talked about that has like four Protect the Negotiators and four Wandering Emperors. I think that that deck goes a ways to addressing this, which is that you are playing a 24 land aggressive deck because of your like mana requirements and all your three drops. And there's just like, no, like, your cards are just kind of, like, there. They aren't, like, the best. They're not really two for ones. Like, yeah, you might access to, like, Extraction Specialist or, like, you know, Wedding Announcement out of the board. But, like, the majority of your cards are just, like, Athalia that dies to removal, a Valiant Veteran that dies to removal. And you aren't, like, gaining, like, the mono red decks at least have this idea where they're, like, 21, 22 lands. I'm going to draw two more spells in the Grixis deck a game, and that's how I'm going to leverage it. This deck has none of that. And any game where anything goes slightly wrong, you're just immediately rolled over by the fact that the Grixis deck is suddenly playing at parity with you with cards that are just 8 million times better at one for one-ing and like winning this game. And like, that's a really bad problem with this deck that Wandering Emperor tries to fix. That all said, I think the biggest edge Soldiers has is that it is the biggest deck in any kind of aggressive mid game. Like, you go over the top, you produce a lot of resource, like, against non-removal, like, this is the deck with the Lords. Your Resolute Reinforcements, like, produces so much material. You have Brutal Cathar, you have Harbin, you have all this stuff, like, Siege Veteran, Skystrike Officer, like, things that will run away with the game if your opponent is just letting you do your stuff. I think that that is, like, a huge edge for this deck, is that it's eating up this other segment of the metagame.
I do want to shout out Zephyr Sentinel too. That card looked phenomenal, both against me and in general this weekend. And I think given the dynamics you're laying out, that makes a lot of sense, because you don't want to just play a two drop that dies and then they immediately get to eat it with Corpse Appraiser or something. You don't want a card that even, you know, you draw it on turn five and now it just is going to get brickwalled by the Corpse Appraiser or just literally anything else that's there on the ground. So having this evasive threat with flash that can also potentially line up well against opposing removal, like, that is everything there is good stuff.
Yeah, I also think that the like complete lack of Yoshin frontliners in exchange for like Skrelv is really awesome. Like, that's just how you should be doing things. Yeah, I think that those two cards, like Zephyr Sentinel, great. Definitely put that card in your deck. I think that that is the sort of right direction to push everything.
Yeah, and so with that in mind, I think Soldiers is a very strong choice and a deck that you do have to take seriously moving forward. Let's talk about the Toxic deck as well. So this is the classic all cards from a single set deck, like the tribal deck contained within a set or a block. And those decks have had a really hard time of things over the past few years, where I think back to like the Knights deck from Throne of Eldraine or whatever, where it's like, we really want this deck to be good, and people like Ken Yukihiro tried their best, but it's just, it's not that good in the end. And usually those tribal aggro decks have really failed to perform, and they've had a pretty bad track record. So I'm sure there are people inside R&D who are hooting and hollering with joy that, you know, Toxic is everywhere and Soldiers had a good weekend. Like, it felt like something finally clicked in that regard, and those decks are doing well again.
Well, you want to know what the trick is here. I already described what it was when I was talking about the red deck, where the ideal red deck for this format would just be 8 million copies of Jackal Pup. This deck gets to play 12 Jackal Pup. Every single creature with Toxic, if you are ending every game with Toxic, like a Toxic 1 creature is a Jackal Pup. And this deck is really well positioned against any opponent who is, like, that's great. Like, you're going to come out ahead on mana, and then all these 1-drops are really good when targeted with removal anyways. So, like, anytime your opponent's plan is just to, like, kill your stuff one for one, gonna be really good for you. It's a little weak. It's somewhere like between weaker and more resilient to sweepers than you'd expect. Like, they're obviously very good, but there's a lot of like odds and ends that survive, so like that can't be the entirety of your opponent's plan. So like, if you're, and also like the land base in this deck, you know, really min-maxing with like Seed Core and Mirex both playing pretty big roles in terms of like getting value. Like, you're a 22 land deck that plays as if it's like 19. You have a lot of good stuff going on here with the literally every, I guess some of the lists, it looks like one of the top 8 lists from Vancouver has Soul Partition instead of Charge of the Mites, which I'm entirely here for, like, any card that isn't Charge of the Mites, because I think that one should stay in the draft decks. You know, these are all cards from a single set, like you said, like shockingly good and like shockingly cohesive, and they somehow managed to like actually put a full curve in without letting anyone realize.
Yeah, I do think the mana is actually a big part of both of those decks' success as well. So how many promising aggro decks have we seen in the past? But yeah, the spells maybe have what it takes, but the mana just isn't there. You have like 8 dual lands in your 2-color deck, except 4 of those are these like the Glacial Fortress cycle or some other cycle which really are not conducive to casting 1-drops of 2 different colors on turn 1. And it's like, okay, well, even if these spells are good, which maybe they are, I just can't cast them in the way I need to. Both of these decks, so the Soldiers deck, you have Seagrim Coast, a Darker Waste, you have both land cycles which are very conducive to aggro, you have a Fortified Beachhead as the Soldier specific untapped dual land, and then also Secluded Courtyard. So you can cast your Soldiers, that is never going to be a real problem there. And then this deck as well, you've got your Razor Earth Thicket and your Brushland, but also the fact that you get so much value over the course of the game from both the Seed Core and Mirex, I think really is what takes the deck to the next level as well.
Yeah, and so a lot of this is stuff that's going to persist, not now, but like for another year, because we got 2 untapped dual land cycles in the same sort of pseudo block, right? Because it was Dominar United, Brothers War, that's the pain lands. And then the next 2 sets are going to be the like fast lands for the most part, right? Or I don't know if the rest of that cycle might not be coming in the next set, but like still, you have ally color of that. Like that's a really huge thing for the next year of decks. I do have... Again, this is like, I talk about all these decks that aren't Grixis and one other deck that we'll get to, and I think they just have like some significant structural issues. Like, my issue with the Selesnya deck is really apparent whenever you pair it up against Soldiers, which is that you just don't have a lot of stuff that like extends your ability to like adjust a race or like make your cards better if they're getting attritioned and blocked down. They're just kind of like, they're there.
Yeah, going wide against just any reasonably sized blocker is actually surprisingly difficult a lot of the time. And this has been the issue with any kind of like tokens deck or whatever in the past, is unless you have the anthems to go with them, well, just a bunch of 1/1s very quickly gets clowned upon by just a 2/2 standing in the way yelling stop. So you have some ways to break through that, but not nearly as many as I would like. And so, yeah, like, is Mirex a good card in longer games? Yes, if the bodies that it's making have some kind of value going long, but if they just have a Bloodtithe Harvester and a Corpse Appraiser, well, that Mirex actually needs a lot of support in order for those random pieces of material to become relevant game pieces. And I think that's a spot that the Toxic deck finds itself in too often for my liking. Let's finish here then with the deck that I think maybe had the best weekend out of any deck, and that's Esper Legends. So a known quantity coming in, one of the more successful decks from, you know, previous like 7 or 6 set versions of this standard format. I don't know what really took this deck a level up. I guess the European list that did very well was essentially pre-boarded for the Grixis Mirror, so some lists had Four Wedding Announcement in the sideboard, and the European list just moved those to the main deck, for example. Or there's always been this issue of, we kind of want a few more 2-drops to go along with our Thardias and our Ardenics, but none of the options are that inspiring. And so, yeah, what if we just play some Transmogrants in those spots? Because we're probably boarding out that 2-drop against most opponents anyway, so why not play the one that is lights out against Grixis? And so I think that approach makes a lot of sense, and I think the thing that, you know, I was drawn to this deck initially, the thing that warned me off it a little bit was just I wasn't doing as well against Grixis as I would have liked, and if these changes fix that, then I think it's a great place to be.
I've said there are 2 good decks, Grixis and the other deck that I've really liked is Esper Legends. I need to experiment more with some of the non-Esper Legends, and I think we can touch on that after, but like the basic game plan of this deck were like, you were just saying X percentage of my cards are really good and my deck is really good at making sure those cards don't die is awesome. Like, Shieldred is so good because your opponents can't beat it if it doesn't die. Like, their entire deck will not, like, head-to-head will just lose. The same is true of, like, Rafine. The same is true of Adeline. And the deck between Plaza of Heroes and Thalia and Skrelv is just so good at making sure those cards remain on the battlefield and that your opponents just, like, can't answer them and then they die.
Yeah, so if the Grixis deck is all about interaction and not presenting any good opportunities for opposing interaction to really do much. This deck is almost the exact opposite philosophically. Is I will present a steady stream of high impact threats and ways to protect them, and if any one of those sticks for any length of time, the game is effectively over, and I will make you render all of those irrelevant somehow. One issue is that one way to kneecap a lot of those threats is just to cut out their support. So, for example, Rafine, Adeline, these cards are so good if you can curve 2 into 3 and then maybe back them up with something else. If your 2-drop dies and you're just left with a naked Adeline or Rafine, often doesn't look that impressive. As a legend-themed deck, you do run into the classic legendary issue sometimes of, my first Thalia isn't that great and now I just drew a second Thalia, or my first Adeline can't attack and now I have a second Adeline, but I need to draw the first Rafine instead, so I have a way to trade in that Adeline for something else. So you do invite certain kind of obvious issues, and one issue I was finding against Grixis was I had a memorable game in testing where my opponent forgot that Denik would turn off Corpse Appraiser, and so they just played it out. But as it turned out, the Corpse Appraiser turned off my Denik because they had a 3-3 and I had a 2-3, and without any further support, it just couldn't attack, and so I spent 2 mana to not really accomplish anything. And the legendary lands as, interaction / mana sources, they're really appealing there as a kind of flexible source of flood protection, but I don't know. It felt like this is a deck which you play exactly one sorcery speed spell every turn, and if that's good, then great, and if it's not, then you can't really do much, or you can't catch off from behind very well, and that's just the bargain that you accept.
I've kind of had the experience where the legendary lands were the way to do that, where, like, the games where I feel like I am behind, the card I need to turn the corner is being able to Odawara their blocker, or Iganjo their attacker, or whatever, and, like, the fact that they are actually significantly cost per, like, you Odawara for one a lot with this deck, and I was really impressed with that. I'm just, like, looking at the European list that Nico Boni and Thorald Severin played, and the other thing I want to highlight is, so we talked about, like, this deck gets to play, like, 12 lands that are spells. You'll notice that there are just, like, zero copies of Rafine's Tower, and I think that Xander's Lounge is, like, probably the worst land in Grixis, and it's, I think the last time I said this was about, like, a common and limited, but, like, the ideal deck in this format is a deck that looks like it wants a Triome and then just doesn't play the Triome.
Yeah, you're trying to curve out 2 into 3 into 4 every game, and if you ever need to top deck a land in order to do that, and you draw the Rafine's Tower, like, the game can just, that can be a game-ending difference, and you have a lot of lands which, in that spot, are effectively Rafine's Towers, so, Seagrim Coast or Darkdeck Shores pass the first few turns. You need to be able to curve out, and often the card Rafine's Tower is the biggest obstacle to doing that, as odd as that might seem on the surface.
Yeah, I guess, like, counting down their list relative to the stock list, I think it's probably worth just talking about the legends that didn't make the cut that are usually used to buffer against that legend issue of, like, oh, I drew multiple legends, so I'm just going to play, like, 2s and 3s. So, like, cutting the Raven Man, fine. That card is, like, it makes more birds than you expect, but it's not good. Toulouse, I hate that card. That card is just, like, it never does what you want it to. It's really inefficient. Just never play that card. The other stock ones, I am a little more willing to put back into their deck. So, I think that Loran is, like, a totally fine and powerful card. Like, we've talked about it being good against a lot of decks, and I could see wanting it in the main deck a lot. Airtai Resurrected, I just really like that card. I think it's just quite powerful and, like, a worthy inclusion if you find room for another 4-drop. And then you were talking about Ao, the Dawn Sky. Like, that card's also just, I don't want to say phenomenal, but, like, the fact that it is, like, the big Sarah Angel sizing on it wins a lot of matchups that are unexpected has been my experience.
Yeah, this was one issue with earlier builds of the deck, is running all of these nonsense legends, which would work with your other nonsense legends, but none of which would be in the deck in the first place, were they not legends. Like, I think if the deck was just called Esper Midrange, no one would be trying to cram, like, Raven Mans and Toulouses and all of this stuff into it. And yeah, I think just playing the good cards instead, shockingly, turns out to be a much more sound approach.
Yeah, so I would like your opinion on something. How much of the Esper Mirror have you played?
Not a ton, and I'm not sure I want to play a ton of it.
Okay. I have had very swingy experiences with Wedding Announcement in that mirror, and I don't know what you are supposed to do with it. So I'm, like, open to opinions. Like, I have gotten destroyed by it because one of the things you sort of want to do in the Esper is become the control deck that can answer their legends better, but, like, that instantly loses to Wedding Announcement. But on the other hand, like, if your opponent just, like, plays the Adeline Children, you're just like, well, that's great card. Throwing that one away. Or, like, Athalia. Like, there's just, I don't know. It's a tough ask, and I don't quite know where it should fall.
I would be pretty skeptical about it personally. I think that the nature of both mirrors in general and this mirror means that you're going to have a lot of these less than ideal cards. So this is not a Thalia matchup, I think it's fair to say. I think actually the transmogrants here can be good just because you're happy to just ram those into something or discard those for a fiend, bring them back later. There's not the same lineup versus removal there is against Grixis, but you don't need that to be necessarily. I think the games can evolve into I cut down your first thing, or you go for the throat my thing, and then my other legend, because it has this issue we mentioned of needing to pair up with other creatures to do anything, well, that's now a bit neutered. And in those games, Wedding Announcement can look pretty good, but I think there are equally going to be a lot of games where they just curve 2 into 3 and your 3-drop is Announcement, and that is nowhere close to good enough.
Yeah, I don't quite know, but yeah, that's just something to think about for that.
I will say as well, the other thing I like about the Europeanness is just 4 main deck Shieldred. I think this is a great deck of just casting and protecting Shieldred, and often that is enough to win you otherwise lost games. And in a lot of both matchups and positions, Shieldred is your best card. It is phenomenal alongside Rafine, phenomenal against Rafine as well. Just play for Shieldred. It is the easiest ticket to 3 wins, and there's no reason to dilute that with... I mean, I like Urtai too, and I like Ao. I like some of these other higher curve options, but you start with 4 Shieldred and you build up from that, in my view.
Yes, I agree with that, and that is probably the reason that those cards are not showing up. I guess we should probably talk about the more color legend decks that feature Slowgurk the Overslime. I am, like, imminently skeptical of that card in a format where people appear to be playing more and more Denix every single week.
That comes up against, you know, Soldiers and the Mirror matchups where otherwise the Tetsuon Denix just basically does nothing, and its main job is being, like, a kind of mopey-ish lifelinker, which is fine, I suppose. Against something like Grixis, though, this is a card which actually lets you grind them out in a way that the Esper deck can struggle with sometimes. So my experience against Grixis was I kind of needed one of those nut draws where I curve 2 into 3 into 4, or maybe Scrub was in there instead at some point, and just had to run them over, because if I didn't, I would very easily just get brickwalled by, you know, removal into Corpse Appraiser, or just basically anything into Shieldred, or Fable would be a massive problem in the longer games. And Slowgurk is a card which actually puts the ball back in their court, and they now have to find an answer to this card, which, as the game goes long, will be bigger than anything they can block it with, and has trample, but will also just draw 3 effectively spells when it dies. And sometimes you get into these elaborate, like, Takanuma Slowgurk loops, or Odawara saving Slowgurk loops. It is a very difficult card to deal with permanently. And then I think the other green cards are important too. So Glissar, for example, there are some of these removal light aggro decks, including the Mirrors, Soldiers, Toxic, they really cannot deal effectively with a Glissar on offense or on defense. And First Strike plus Death Touch is a lethal combination. And then Malira is fantastic too. Not just against Toxic, where, yeah, sometimes you just turn 2 Malira on the play against them and the game's over right there. But also just, you want this 2-drop, which can protect your legends and also hits hard, can attack into a Fable token or a Corpse Appraisal or something. And Malira just does everything. It is the exact card that this Esper Legends deck would kill to play if only it was on color. And so... you do make some sacrifices in the process, and I think there are certainly, you know, adding a 4th color opens up its own realm of nonsense legends, which you should probably cut for your deck, and Old Rustine comes to mind there. But just as a concept, I think the deck actually has a lot going for it.
The one card in this deck that sort of rings a memory bell about another point in the format is the Thruns that are showing up in this deck sideboard. I'm glad that this deck has the appropriate mana to cast them, because one of the other experiences I had with the Bant deck was I would bring in these cards that were like Thrun or whatever, and I just couldn't cast them. So I think that there are, when you are extending your mana base, if you are not leaning on Plaza of Heroes, it is easy to put cards in your deck that are double color and just like you're just double splashing. That just doesn't work. It works fine if you have Plaza because that, you know, fudges all the numbers, but yeah.
And notably in this deck, Thrun with Plaza of Heroes, the way you kill Thrun is either to, if you're a deck that has depopulate or something, maybe you have to rely on that, or you just try and chuck enough stuff in front of it, or maybe a Shieldred with Death Touch or something, and Plaza neuters both of those options. So yeah, in the matchups where you're bringing in Thrun, it is often just effectively actually unkillable.
Yeah. I think on this note of alternate decks, the one other deck that interests me in a world where we are saying these aggressive decks have pushed people trying to go over Grixis out of the metagame is the Jund deck. I think that there, I don't want to say that there are clear reasons to play Jund over Grixis, but I have like been fairly impressed. Like, I mean, it may just be that the Jund deck has all the same cards as Grixis, but like, I don't know, like Meeglaws has seemed relatively impressive. Unleash the Inferno is relatively impressive. I would not be surprised to see spots where the Jund deck is a reasonable call relative to Grixis under some like fairly specific conditions.
Yeah, you have some 2-drop options too, like Armored Scrap Gorger, I think it is, can look pretty impressive. And then, yeah, again, like Unleash the Inferno is appealing, but there are no other Jund cards which are drawing you into the Jund deck. It's more of just like this Gruul card over here and this Golgari card over here. And it's again like, why does Streets of New Capenna drop the ball on that whole approach so badly? It's it really does stick in my craw.
Yeah. Among the many issues with that set is the never printing a gold card that people want to play.
Mm-hmm. So with that, I think we've covered most of the decks in the format. Like, we didn't dwell for long on like the domain decks or what have you, but the fact that we cycled through 7 or 8 different archetypes, covering most of the spectrum in terms of aggro and then control, mid-range. I guess there's no like hard control deck. There's no combo deck, really. We got a tempo deck of sorts in there, if you want to use that word. But you have a much more refreshing and appealing mix than seemed possible in this format a few weeks ago. And I think that's a really nice thing to be able to say.
Yeah, I mean, you did describe it as like all varying shades of like aggro to mid-range, but they all feel really unique. And that's really nice.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one of the bigger criticisms I would level at the format, and this is a cautionary tale for people out there if you're playing a big standard tournament, especially in paper soon, is there's just so much stuff. Like, the board gets so cluttered, and the mono-white deck is the most guilty of this, but even in, like, the Grixis mirrors or whatever, all of these game pieces make more game pieces, and it makes this token and that token, and there's just so much stuff happening on the board that, A, you have to be trained to keep track of that, and if you haven't had to do that kind of stuff in paper in a while, that can be quite disorienting at first. But also, you need to do that in a timely fashion. So, yeah, if you're playing a Grixis mirror and it looks like it's going long, if you are, let's say you untap, you draw your card, you slowly tick up your Fable, you think about what you're going to discard to it, and then after 15 seconds, you tap your lands a little inefficiently, you play a Bloodtithe Harvester, you go and pick up your box, and you open it, you grab your tokens, and you flip through them looking for the blood token. You can't be doing that. All of this needs to be crisp and efficient. Ideally, all of these supplementary tokens and stuff should be there, ready to go within easy reach. Like, you gotta take the time pressure seriously and show a sense of urgency. And if you aren't doing that, then your opponent should be pressuring you to do that, because both players have an incentive for the game to reach a natural conclusion, and you are one of those players, and you are part of that.
That is how I received my one draw in Pro Tour and Grand Prix history. And yes, the physical aspect of these decks in the game object tribal design era cannot be understated.
Yeah, the mono white deck was an especially bad choice given that, where we had very nice large tables at the GP, or at the RC, excuse me. So you had a lot of room for your playmat, your box, your notepad, and everything else beside, with some elbow room to spare. And even then, you know, we had tokens spinning off the playmat, and I know Autumn was very frustrated in playing a mono white mirror where their opponent was just using a bunch of like dice to represent tokens. That is an absolute no-no. You cannot be doing that. But I had to mock up 5 or 6 different kinds of tokens between like samurais with vigilance, samurai with double strike, human tokens, and then the pilot tokens for Bankbuster, which also makes a treasure token, but you can't forget that the pilot can also crew the Bankbuster when it couldn't normally. There's just, it's overwhelming. There is a lot of stuff, and I think that is one valid criticism of both this format and just recent trends in card design, is all the cards do so much, and it's easy for everything to just kind of like blur together into one big blob.
I'm just now realizing that Wedding Announcement and Sanctuary Warden make significantly different tokens.
They sure do, yep.
Oh, I hate everything about this.
I didn't even make a distinct token for my one copy of Sanctuary Warden, but I probably should have, right? If I was doing my due diligence, then I certainly should have.
Yeah, when your opponent plays the anti-green card from Streets of New Capenna, then you're in big trouble.
Well, one thing that legitimately came up was Skrelv giving its own unique form of protection. Like, the pilot tokens are colorless. The spirit tokens from the backside of Restoration of Igandro are colorless. And so, yeah, if you're just haphazardly using the same things to represent whatever's on the board, it's easy for the color distinction to get lost as well.
Let's move on anyway. From this. Yeah.
So on that happy note, we'll close out here with a brief look at the results from the week. What caught your eye just scanning over these?
The modern results were, I guess, sort of like we've sort of hit one of those like plateaus in normalcy in the format. But the thing that popped out to me was this was a really good weekend for footfalls. Just like stock, no frills footfalls putting up a lot of results.
Yeah, and that has been the case for some time now. It feels like a stock list of sorts has developed, and some of that is just, you know, Isaac Bullwinkle and the same players just winning week by week. I will beat the drum until I die. Play more than 24 lands in this deck, please. I don't think there's any excuse not to at this point, but they disagree, and therefore every person who just copies the list that won the last challenge, which is one of them, is going to disagree as well. So I accept that is a losing battle at this point.
Yeah, I just pulled up the FER MTG list that won the challenge on Sunday, and there are 24 lands. No, I'm 100% with you. I'm playing like more lands and a better mana base. I think that this is like, just like cast your spells, it's really great. Other deck this weekend that was I don't want to say like footfalls winning it's not surprising, but it's like, yes, this is notable. The deck that's surprising to me is the Jund Saga deck putting up a lot more results.
Yeah, it felt like something in that space was maybe poised for a return. I mean, we highlighted when Jund Saga was doing well initially, lining up well against footfalls would be a big part of that. So I don't know if those two things are linked here once again.
That's very possible. Yeah. And the metagame, like, becoming more normal and more fair just has to be good for Jund, right?
Yeah, I think also if one of the narratives before is the four-color decks could just kind of outgrind Jund, and four-color is back in maybe not a big way, but some kind of way, and Jarvis took us through the ins and outs of that last week. But as we wait for those lists to become refined, and, you know, I think without Urion, they aren't as good at grinding as they used to be, then that's just not an issue that you have to worry about with your Jund deck as much these days.
Yeah, that's true. I guess we may have, like, the pickup of Haywire Might is certainly very powerful. And, like, the amount of Urza Saga in the metagame has been fluctuating somewhat upward lately, and, like, being the Might deck in the mirror is pretty good.
Yeah, there hasn't been a ton of Hammer lately. I think that was held up as one of the weaker matchups for Jund, but I think that is a lot better now, and part of that is just Haywire Might beyond anything else.
Yeah, also, there's just been a lot of people, like, I think that, you know, we talk about this resurgence of four color. This is also a really good weekend for creativity, a good weekend for Jund. Two or three weeks ago was a really good weekend for people who just pretended Ren and Six didn't exist, and that may be, like, some free wins that you are picking up that maybe you shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. We had Demonic Tutors branching out, top 8ing yet another challenge. That part is no surprise, but with the Fair Breach check this time around, expanding his range even further.
Yeah, he also had like another near miss. Yeah, I don't know. I don't love the Fair Breach deck. I would much rather have Murktide Regent in my deck, but it continues to win at a decent clip, and like at the very least, the cards are comparable in some degree.
Yeah, but we also had a Pro Tour finalist, Benton Madsen, B Madman on Magic Online, continuing this amazing run with, I think it was the Super Qualifier that he went all the way in with Fairbreach featuring a copy of An Offer You Can't Refuse. So this is the blue counter spell that counters a non-creature spell, and its controller creates two treasure tokens. And so I think its primary role there is to actually let you, in these Fairbreach games, convert those into unfair breach games by letting your breach generate mana over time. So you can make a bunch of mana and then maybe launder that into, you know, successive expressive iterations or whatever the next move is. Although there's no actual like combo finish here. There's no, you know, there's no residual grape shot hanging out for those games.
Yeah, I guess one of my issues with the Fairbreach deck can be summed up with, like, how do you have a bunch of, like, the games where it's like you have a bunch of cards in your graveyard and five lands on the battlefield to cast Bolt out of your graveyard three times and you haven't won anyways feel like they're kind of rare, and it feels like you're missing one of those resources, and like Offer might branch you towards the mana part of that equation.
Yeah, the other deck that I'm excited to see doing well here is the Goryeo's Atraxa deck. So this is an idea which a lot of people kind of gravitated towards early when Atraxa was released. I picked up my Atraxa's day one of release just to play that deck at locals, and was glad I did because they promptly doubled in price the day after. But we're seeing it actually put up a few repeated results, and you love to see it, even though I actually have some pretty big issues with the way these decks tend to be built. And I think that there are some structural issues which become apparent the more that you play with the deck.
Which list are you talking about, and what are those issues?
So, I mean, the big one is that the Grief Ephemerate stuff, or the Solitude Ephemerate stuff, it is a nice angle to have access to, and it is a great follow-up to what do you do once you draw a bunch of cards with your Atraxa or your Grizzlebrand. I think the issue, though, is people are stuck in the mindset of maybe like Scam, where this is a thing you do, and it just puts you far ahead in the game by itself, as opposed to its role in this deck, where you lower resources for both players. You're each trading off a bunch of cards, but then where that leaves you is that you are a plus b combo deck that actually needs a bunch of stuff in place to get anything else going, and they are a deck which is maybe more well equipped to fight this low resource battle. Whereas Scam, the entire conceit there is, I'll grief scam you, we'll both be down a bunch of cards, maybe my grief dies, and then when the dust settles there, I can win the fight that ensues from that because my entire deck is built around that goal. Whereas here, it's easy to grief plus ephemerate on turn one, and okay, great, I did the thing, and now I'm left with like a third land that maybe isn't doing anything, and an Atraxa that I can't get in my graveyard, and a Goryeo's Vengeance that currently doesn't have any targets, and you're just spinning your tires until something else presents itself to let you participate.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the Sam Black concept of like big games versus little games, and your combo decks are almost always going to want to play big games, whereas your Seasoned Pyromancer Thoughtseize deck wants to play little games, and therefore when you shred your opponent's hand with grief, much better outcome for the other deck. Yes, so that has also been my experience with the Ephemerate lists of this deck, is that like, this was one of the decks I played Scam at RCQ 2 weekends ago, like this was a matchup I played, and the fact that my deck was very good off the top of their deck on no resources meant I was way ahead at all times.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is I think once you become just a Goryeo's Vengeance combo deck, well, there is a natural bottleneck there around the card Goryeo's Vengeance. And yeah, sometimes you won't be able to find it, or you'll draw one copy and it'll get interacted with. And the interaction in Modern is very, very good these days. And so I still think you need Priest of Fellrise as redundancy to let you just combo off quickly in the games where you can do that, and then that card is what lets you play the longer games, because once you get to five mana you have this uncountable finisher that you can play from the graveyard that just plops a Grizzlebrand or an Atraxa into play, and that's what lets you do the, you know, Solitude your Legisreader thing three turns earlier to set that up.
Yeah, I think that might be a good description of the limited number of issues I had with the list that appears to be doing, I guess, I don't know, they're both doing okay, but the list that I prefer, which is the Urza Saga Asmo Emrakul version. I think the deck is just like fundamentally more powerful. Like the Esper list just like can't turn to an Atraxa, and therefore I just like, I don't know, I don't think it's operating on a different level than anything else. But like the problem with this, the other deck is like, it has all these other angles, but it is very easy to reduce those other angles to like I don't know, like, some amount of, like, not every deck is going to care about Asmo or Urza Saga or, like, whatever the heck your other game plan is. So it's very easy to reduce the game plans that matter to, like, I don't know, I just need to counter your Goryeo's Vengeance and beat an Urza Saga. And, like, both of those are exploitable plans, and it's, like, it's the reverse of the Breach deck where, like, you don't just have this baseline fair plan to punch through when your opponent decides to exploit two of your plans. Like, your two plans that matter just get exploited and you die, which can happen, like, if your opponent has, like, Force of Vigor and Endurance. Like, that is my one issue with that deck, but otherwise I think it's very scary and powerful.
Yeah, and I think ultimately those two decks are different enough that I wouldn't even call them versions of each other. They both have Goryeo's Vengeance, but just the way that they use that card and approach that card are different enough that, yeah, I would view them as our own decks, both of which I have a lot of interest in. But yeah, if I had to pick one for a tournament at this stage, I think it would be the Sorceress deck. So with that, I think we can wrap things up here. So as always, you can be finding me on Twitter at Domin Javier, you on Twitter at AIMLX. You can find the pod there at Dominaria _ pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. We give a lot of thanks to Nick, who did that this week as our new patron. We welcome them to the Patreon and also to the Discord, where us and many other fine folks are hanging out as well. So hope to see you there. You can find my columns on SCG and yours on CFB TCG Player. And you can find us back in here next week with something. We'll get back to you.
Hold up. You can also find me on Jarvis's stream later this week playing our real quick hits nonsense of the week. I do want to shout out Hank the Obese for providing us even more content this time in a fake format. So we're going to talk about Legacy as fast as possible, but... So they banned the initiative, and we had Jarvis on to talk about that. But apparently, initiative is still here, but I just wanted to shout out this deck that not only makes you learn about the initiative, but learn about the card Arena Rector. This is just true Orzhov scam in Legacy. It's just classic Cabal Therapy plus a Rector of some kind. So it is Arena Rector getting sacrificed to Therapy to put Ugin, Nicobolas, or 7-mana Kaya onto the battlefield with your initiative cards, with Opposition Agent in your deck, and, like, with a Gaia's Blessing in the sideboard against all these grindstone haters. I don't know. I'm a big fan of whatever's going on here.
Yes, I know you have sacrificed many a Academy Rector to Cabal Therapy and Phyrexian Tower in your day, so I'm sure this brought back some happy brain chemicals for you.
Yes. That's my one shout-out for the week and our quick hits nonsense for the Legacy format.
Yes, so you can find whatever that amounts to over on twitch.tv/JarvisU sometimes later in the week. But until then, I think finally, we will let you get out of here and take care, everyone.